So this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance Radio, and I'm with Robert Roop Bernstein, that we're welcoming here to Dallas again.
Glad to be here.
And Robert and I actually are longtime colleagues and collaborators. He's an editor on the Leonardo Journal, and particularly he's been covering the art-science connection, which is one of the topics I think that we'll talk about today. So, Robert, maybe you could just in a few sentences tell us about your professional background and what you're working on at the moment.
Okay. I have a rather unusual background in that I'm both a scientist, a historian. My PhD is actually in history of science, and I run a physiology laboratory. But my real research has to do with what makes people more creative than other people and what we can learn from the most creative people that we can help other people improve their own skills.
And that's a very popular topic these days because we're all in the innovation economy. and I think what's interesting in the work that you've been doing is you've actually been collecting evidence and data, looking at large numbers of creative people, and looking at some of their habits.
Yep. So probably starting 30 years ago, I got interested in what makes some scientists more successful than others, fortunately fell in with a number of studies, one that was actually run by my mother at UCLA, involving a large number of scientists over many years, started analyzing why some of them got Nobel Prizes and some of them didn't even get tenure. And among the strange things that dropped out was that the very successful people were much more engaged in arts and crafts and creative writing and things like that than the people who weren't. And more interestingly, not only did they do these things at much higher rates, but they actually thought that they were important to their scientific creativity. So they could, you know, tell you how they used their knowledge of, say, composing music to analyze a geological problem or, you know, think about physics in any
way. So I guess one of the things that as you just said, these people, when you interviewed them, said that these avocations that they had, they didn't consider a waste of time, or mm-hmm. they wished they worked more in the office.
Right.
But they really viewed it as the way they went about having new ideas and attacking hard problems.
Yes. Their time usage was very different than the less successful people. Actually, the most successful people actually seemed to take more time off. They were very clear about when a research project was working. They could work very hard for, you know, a while to make it successful. But they also realized that once they had been successful working on one problem, they needed to get new ideas and start on a new problem. So where do you get new ideas from? And mostly they said you go off and you think about different aspects of your life. You take time off. You combine a scientific problem with an artistic problem. You do analogies where you take an idea in one field and see how you can apply it in another field, things like that.
So there are several aspects of this. And then, one of them, I think, which as you've heard you talk about it before, is that the most successful scientists and engineers actually typically work on a number of problems, and then they shift from one problem to another when they get stuck, or
right.
they totally give up a problem and come back to it 20 years later.
Yep.
Whereas the less successful ones, somehow they're going to solve this problem, and they work on it for 18 years and fail miserably.
Yeah, so we've actually looked at probably about 100 scientists or so at this point and looked at their the fields in which they worked or the specific problems they worked on in terms of what they publish. And those scientists who had the least impact tended to work on literally one problem their entire life. It would usually be the problem they studied when they got their PhD, and they would simply do that for the next 30 years till they retired. They could publish a fair number of papers, but basically nobody read them. The people who were the most successful, and actually the most successful scientist we've ever found, is Richard Feynman in terms of impact. He had only 79 papers in his entire life, which is probably about a third of the average scientist, far less than most Nobel Prize winners. And yet, I think it was something like 40 of those papers are among the highest cited papers in all of physics. And in order to do that, he not only worked on multiple problems at the same time, but switched from one problem to another literally every couple of years. So the number of areas he worked on was almost as large as the number of papers that he published. And I mean, that's astounding, because it means he had to become a novice over and over and over again.
When I hear you talking about Richard Feynman, I think we all remember his drumming.
Yeah.
And so I think another factor that you kind of looked into is physical activity.
Yep.
Outside of the work context. And what did you find there?
So the people who are most successful in science, and actually this, we've looked at Nobel Prize winners across all the different disciplines, tend to be much more physically active than people who aren't. And again, that seems to have something to do with, well, we now know there's actually probably a physiological basis for this. People who age well, don't get Alzheimer's and things like that, tend to be people who are physically active, and that's because the amount of blood flow they get through the brain as they age continues to be higher than people who aren't. So the more active you are, literally the more active your brain can be.
And I think you gave another example of how a number of these Nobel Prize winners had surfing as an activity.
Yes. So one of the most unexpected results was that not only were these people very active, but they were very exploratory and daring. So when most of the people that in one of the studies we looked at had grown up in or were working in Southern California, and when surfing started to become a craze, they all took up surfing. And when hang gliding became the craze, they all took up hang gliding. And when, you know, mountain climbing or rock climbing became the craze, they took up rock climbing. The average person doesn't do that to begin with, let alone the average scientist. So
I guess
daring.
The obvious conclusion, which I guess we sort of know, is that if you want to create an environment where people are successful, creative, and innovative, you somehow have to consider the whole person and not just what they're doing from 9 to 5 or sitting at their classroom desk.
Yep, absolutely. And all these people said that what made them different, and they were actually very self-reflective about this, was that they tried to integrate their lives. Everything they did fit together. So they didn't feel that going off and hang gliding or mountain climbing or whatever was time away from, say, their physics or their biology. It was a way to think about it in a new and different way, in a different context, to refresh their minds, get out of their ruts, and so forth and so on. And the people who were the least successful actually said, what I should be doing is being in the lab 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, which from our experience is actually the wrong thing to be
doing.
It's
counterproductive. Yep. to that kind of innovation.
Yeah.
I think you also made a number of other observations that again, we kind of know, but I think given that you have quantitative data on it, it's sort of interesting to reinforce it, is that you found very little correlation between where someone did their undergraduate degree and their later success in science and engineering.
Yeah, so we decided to look at the sort of the geography of success. I mean, is there a place you need to be? You know, people in New York City, you know, are they much more successful than people in, you know, Podunk, wherever it is? And it turns out it depends somewhat on the stage of your career, but in terms of undergraduate education, it made absolutely no difference where you grew up or where you went to school. In fact, in some cases, there were some negative correlations that were quite unexpected. Going to an Ivy League school or Caltech or MIT as an undergraduate actually was negatively correlated with ending up with a Nobel Prize or in the National Academy, which, you know, you wouldn't expect that, whereas going to Antioch or Oberlin or some of these really small liberal arts schools was much more highly correlated.
So why do you think that is?
Well, the reason probably has to do with two things. One is your access to actually getting into, you know, laboratory and doing research starting, say, as a freshman. Lots of these small liberal arts schools, you know, this is the big thing that they're pushing. Individualized, do-it-yourself, direct experience. And that seems to pay off. The other thing is people who are doing research at these small schools are often doing things that are not the cutting edge. They're doing unusual types of research that the students are going to, you know, get lots of experience doing, and then they're going to take them to a cutting-edge school when they say go to graduate school. And that bringing together the cutting-edge technologies with these unusual problems and questions from other types of science, I think is creative in and of itself. It's just, it's a different mindset than the people who are only doing the latest thing with the latest technology all the time.
So you did find a correlation between where someone went to graduate school and right. subsequent success.
So the next stage was looking at graduate school. Does that matter? And that turns out to matter a lot in terms of who ends up in these, you know, major academies and so forth. Part of that's probably social, but a lot of it is simply that when you look where all the funding is, it's going to Harvard and MIT and Stanford and Berkeley and so forth and so on. So if you can't get there, you probably just don't get the access to the really top flight equipment, the latest ideas, the contacts you need to be able to tap into the funding system, the peer review, all that kind of stuff. But then after that, there's another very interesting switch, which is there was sort of a bifurcation in where people went. And about half the people who end up in these major academies and so forth go off to one of the other schools. So they go from Berkeley to Harvard or Harvard to Stanford or things like that. But about half of them actually made a conscious decision. So they actually either write about this or they would tell us in interviews that they didn't want to be at one of the major places. They didn't want to be another cog in this huge, you know, Nobel Prize winning production line or something, or compete with these people who have these mega labs already. They wanted to do a new kind of science. And in order to do that, they would find a small college, a small university, a, you know, somewhere off on the periphery where they had a lot of freedom, or somebody would build them a new lab from scratch or something like that. And they would take that opportunity. And then often it would take them longer to reach this high level of success, but they would build something entirely new in theirs and different from what everyone else was doing. And a lot of those people are really the innovators driving the new sciences.
That's sort of counterintuitive, right?
Yeah.
Because often in what's called innovation theory, you know, you look at places like Silicon Valley and say, if you want to be successful, go to Silicon Valley.
Sure.
But what you're saying is, if you're trying to do something that's kind of outside of the established sort of dominant activity, then you're better off in the periphery somewhere where maybe you can take that risk in a way, maybe without the resources, but you can actually then drill deep on that innovation.
Right. Yep. Unfortunately, you know, people who are successful like to fund people who are doing things they understand. So, I mean, that's the benefit, and it's also the detriment of a Silicon Valley or you know, the Cambridge, Massachusetts, or wherever it is, because people are going to look at it and say, oh, yeah, that's great. I like that idea because it's similar to one that I already know works. So that's where a lot of that funding goes. So if you're doing that kind of work, great. But, you know, if you want to do something that's really off the beaten path or you don't even know that there's a market for this thing, you're trying to create it from scratch, well, the first guys in Silicon Valley, there was nobody there. You know, they had to create that from something, and a Silicon Valley could probably develop almost anywhere.
So do you think the internet changes that? I mean, it's not exactly cause and effect, but that correlation, because, and that, you know, I've sometimes argued that the internet is dangerous because new ideas get made visible too quickly, and then people, you know, kill your idea very too quickly. Whereas, you know, when geography was that important, you could work for 2 or 3 years out of the mainstream and maybe then get the opportunity to develop it. So does the internet actually suppress that kind of innovation?
Yeah, there's always the danger that, you know, when you crowdsource something, people pick the wrong thing. You know, they pick the thing that they understand or feel comfortable with, which isn't actually the thing that's going to work. There's always the problem that you know, where the money is actually counts. So the internet can spread it, and the guy picks up your idea in Silicon Valley where he has access to the venture capital people, and you're sitting in East Lansing, Michigan like I am, and you don't have access to the venture capital people. So you lose out, not because your idea is not good, but because somebody else took it and had the access to the people who can develop it.
I guess some people have been arguing that the way crowdfunding is developing these days, in fact, the venture capital people are beginning to look at people who are successful in crowdfunding it's kind of a proof of concept mm-hmm. in terms of the viability of someone's idea. So maybe the internet will help people who are in isolated places from that point of view of access to capital.
Sure. And actually, even the publishing industry has done similar things. I know a lot of the major bestsellers have started out by people self-publishing. And then by the time you've published, 50,000, 100,000 copies, somebody finally takes a notice and says, oh, we should have published that book. We'll take it now. So,
can I just come back to the cause and effect question? So obviously, you've been looking at what I call longitudinal studies over decades in some cases, trying to look at the patterns in the data between people who are successful later in life, as successful scientists or engineers, and what they were doing 10 years before and so on. So how can one really establish causal effects?
Yeah, that's always a tough one. So yeah, we have large correlational data, and some of them, our studies involve literally tens of thousands of people at this point. So we're fairly sure that there are real relationships between, say, doing arts and sciences and crafts and sciences and things like that and being successful. How do you actually show that's what's going on? So what we've been doing is going the opposite end of the spectrum and looking at individual people, individual case studies. You're a painter, you're a successful physicist, why you do the two things, and getting people actually tell us if there are connections, what the connections are, and so forth. In fact, almost everybody does have a real connection. They can tell you how their artistic avocation stimulated some particular idea or makes them see things in a different way or literally teaches them a method which they can now utilize in their laboratory or all sorts of interesting connections like that. That still isn't, in a sense, proof, as people have pointed out. Well, maybe talented people are just multi-talented. Maybe, but the correlation studies we have really suggest that's not just the case, because you would expect that the more talented a person was, say, in mathematics or something like that, and the more successful they are, the less the probability they would have a second talent of some kind. And yet what we find is exactly the opposite. The more talented they are in their physics or their math or something like that, the more talented they tend to be. Many of the people we've talked to who have Nobel Prizes actually have second careers as professional poets, as professional artists, as professional playwrights. I mean, these are not the things that you expect to find at all. And you don't find them in the average scientist at all. And then the third step is really the one which is going to be the hard one, which is what do you learn from this that you can now apply? So you want to do an active experiment. If we can intervene with a group of kids starting at age 10, give them these experiences for 10 years and see what happens to them 30 years from now in terms of their innovation. Will it affect where this group we train in a particular way actually be more successful?
I mean, it does, and I guess open up the question of whether one can really teach creativity rather than in some way enable it, mm-hmm. Create the conditions where people can explore those kinds of things. And I guess a connected thing is, and I don't know if you've looked at this, but clearly there are forms of knowledge which are explicit, and we know how to write the multiple choice right. questions for. And there are other forms of knowledge which are deeply implicit. Sometimes they're learned through a mentoring relationship with someone that you trust. And so maybe a lot of this also has to do with implicit knowledge yep. that is maybe not reducible to the same kind of methodology as explicit knowledge.
Yeah, that's definitely, I think, the case that a lot of the work that we've been doing is looking at that implicit knowledge. And I think that's actually one of the things that arts and crafts tend to teach you. It's very hands-on. A lot of the arts and crafts can only be learned by working with someone who can do it. You can't learn to play the cello by reading a book about it. You can't even learn to ride a bike by reading a book about it. My father tried that, by the way. He actually had not learned how to ride a bike at about the age of 40, read a manual about bike riding and got on and immediately fell off and hurt himself. Not surprising. So there is this implicit knowledge that you have to develop simply by doing things. And obviously you can learn to do them much more efficiently if you watch an expert who understands how to go about that process. How we get that back in the schools when we have a testing culture which basically just pours information out and has you fill in a dot, I'm not entirely sure, but we have to change people's values in the sense that the hands-on and the implicit knowledge, the intuition, if you will, is part
but
of
I
the
think
whole process.
Connected to that is the, and it's clearly not clear how one goes about it, is that clearly what happens in the classroom context is only part
yes,
of
that's true.
And so, you know, in educational systems, we tend to think of formal education, informal education, but in fact, that activity is something that is part of the overall activities
right.
of the person. Some of which is teachable, some of which is contextual,
yep.
and so that, you know, obviously schools concentrate on the part that can be taught,
yep.
and it opens up a whole sort of different, difficult set of issues of how you do continuing education in a real continuous sense.
Yeah, I think one of the mistakes our culture is making is that because we have professional educators that they're the only people whose job it is to educate. And if you go back to the 19th century, informal after school, apprenticeship, I mean, the number of different ways that people would experience learning in any profession was, I think, much greater than it is now. We actually did a study looking back at a bunch of engineers and scientists asking them, when they, first of all, I mean, it showed this correlation between the arts, crafts, and so forth, success as a scientist or engineer, and particularly people who were patenting and entrepreneurs starting their own companies. The more arts and crafts they had, the more entrepreneurial they were. So very important in terms of, you know, the innovation, invention aspect of all of this. And we also collected data on, you know, at what point in your education system and how in your education did you take up these arts and crafts, and you know, we were hoping the answer would be, you know, third grade, we can give them an art class and, you know, that'll
everything
stimulate
solved,
their immune,
yeah,
that'll take care of everything. We didn't get that. What we actually found was what works is that the people who were the most creative and innovative were the ones who had continuous participation. And again, it was what we were just talking about, that there wasn't one way in which it occurred. Some of these people never had an art class or crafts class in their formal education. It was, they were introduced by, you know, their uncle down the street who had a workshop in his basement. And then that inspired them when they got to college to take an engineering class where they got to learn how to do metalwork. And then they decided that they would take some, you know, after school community classes to develop their skills further. So really it's an entire community support system that needs to be in place. So again, you know, it's just simply putting an art class in somewhere or having a music teacher available isn't going to be the solution here.
Yes, some of that, of course, is the argumentation that leads to what's called the creative communities
yep.
Movement and so on. But I don't really want to go there. One of the things that you've done is along the way of doing this work is some of these ideas crystallized out for you and your wife,
yep.
in fact, who's your close collaborator, Michelle.
Yep.
And you wrote a book called Sparks of Genius,
mm-hmm.
where you sort of identify a dozen sort of key cognitive skills that people need to have under their belt. Can you just talk about those a
sure.
little bit?
So basically part of the information that we got out of all these interviews of the scientists was them talking about what their creative process is, and certainly when they're talking about their science and how it's related to arts or crafts or so, they would explain things, and we would hear them talking about various concepts like, you know, art taught me how to observe more acutely, or my crafts gave me these manipulative, you know, skills which were essential to me being a good experimenter, or I learned how to abstract out the key, you know, information and get a literal feel for how a system works and things like that. And so we sort of just started gathering these key words. My wife was working at the same time and looking at creativity and, you know, people like dancers and poets and novelists and artists, and we were hearing the same words just kept popping up. So after a while, we we tried to synthesize those into these 12 basic concepts. And some of them are very obvious. Everybody observes. Everybody images, you know, the memories of those observations. We have to abstract out the key elements of what we've observed from, you know, the welter of all the different details that are there. You often want to model that so that you can sort of simplify it, play with it, see what you can do with it. Playing itself is a tool. Develop skills and knowledge and understanding of things. So those were some of the things that we found people talking about across all different disciplines. And then we went back and basically looked at the curricula in all these different fields, whether it was arts or crafts or music or science or engineering. And although everybody as a professional said they use these tools, these are not explicitly taught anywhere. We expect a science student to be able to observe, but there's no class on observing. And yet a good scientist will tell you it takes years to learn to be a good observer. We never teach the science student how to abstract out the key information, although abstracting is very much the same thing that you do in abstract painting or trying to winnow down all the information you have into a, you know, two-line poem. How do you abstract all that stuff down to just a few words?
Around here in the art and technology program, one of the very common things, and you find this a lot internationally, is that to succeed today in many fields, you need to know how to collaborate.
Yep.
Do you think it's possible to teach people to be good collaborators?
Well, that's actually part of the whole process that Michelle and I try to teach when we go out and work with teachers. One is a lot of successful innovations occur across disciplines, so you need a common language. So part of the whole reason for distilling out this, you know, observing, abstracting, patterning, playing, all these things was to form a language that people in different disciplines could use in common, because of course we all have these disciplinary languages which divide us, so we need something to link. But we also actually go out and invent hands-on exercises where people not only have to play with each of these different tools and see how they work, they then have to make something with them as a group. So it's always a group project at the end. And that always involves them to start talking about, well, what are the criteria for what this project is going to look like, which is a negotiation. It's always a negotiation. And it's interesting to watch people and encourage them to do things, particularly when you put them in a, you know, time limited. You have, you know, 25 minutes to do this project. They can learn, and they do learn.
At the same time, these are the kind of things that, of course, are very common in film schools, mm-hmm. or architecture schools, where nobody builds a building by themselves.
Right.
You need a team of people with different skills. And so that collaboration training is very common in certain fields. I don't know of any courses that teach scientists to collaborate.
No, it's kind of sad. We're actually developing a course at Michigan State University. I'm working with a transmedia artist named Adam Brown. And what we're devising is a course that will bring scientists, engineers, and MFA students together in the same classroom. And basically, everybody gets a challenge. And the challenge will involve them developing collaborative projects where they are going to have to make something and work across all these different disciplines at the same time. It's based on something that's actually being done at Georgia State University, where they have done the same thing, taking design students together with engineering students. And the fun thing is that, you know, it's difficult at the beginning because people don't speak the same language. They actually have different styles of problem solving and so forth. But you can demonstrate and actually follow the ways that they change the way they work, learn to work in different styles than they had when they started, things like that. So
yeah, there's actually a group of people working on what they call the science of team science,
mm-hmm.
Where indeed scientists are realizing that many scientific activities today involve big science or quite large teams, and that actually teaching of collaboration is probably a very important thing to do. We're going to have to wrap this up. I just want to pick up on you mentioned Adam Brown.
Yep.
And you've been doing something really weird with him.
Very weird.
which is you've been taking scientific experiments and displaying them as artworks.
Yes.
And let me just tell you, one of them that you did was the Harold Urey experiment, where you take a globe of glass and you have electric sparks going through it and organic molecules are created. I'll just tell you the anecdote. You displayed this work in Ars Electronica in Linz. And it was there in the hallway of the conference center, and I was there for 5 days. Every morning I'd walk in past that installation. The first time I walked through and I looked at this thing and I said, what a stupid idea. here's this lab apparatus sitting in the hallway of this conference center. Robert has really got a stupid idea. But let me tell you, every morning when I'd walk into that conference, I started spending more and more time looking at that to see what was growing inside that globe. And immediately it became a performance.
Yeah, exactly.
and so, you've shown that work in a number of places, I think. And can you just tell us about the motivation for doing that? And
yeah. I think Adam and I probably had slightly different motivations going in, and those have sort of grown together. Mine was that I've always been very frustrated that the public, and even actually many science students, get no central understanding of science. They just sit and passively listen to lectures. They don't know where the science come from or how beautiful and exciting and as I said, sensual it is. I mean, you get feelings and emotions with actually doing these things. So I wanted to embody those in something. Adam's very interested in how to make art out of scientific materials and specifically things that have emergent properties that aren't the thing you started with. So how can you make a sculpture that grows if you want? This sculpture doesn't quite grow, but something grows inside of it. It was a first step at trying to do that kind of thing. And it's also been funded by the National Science Foundation because we're putting, in a sense, something that's scientific in art contexts, and NSF's very interested in whether this approach will stimulate people who might never go into a science museum or say they hate science, they're not interested at all, to sit there and look at it and say, what is that? And, why is it doing that? And why is it in an art gallery? And then maybe learn something about what science actually is in terms of this embodied sensual activity.
So I guess my question would be, as you've started this practice with Adam, has actually that process of showing these experiments in public given you scientific ideas in return?
Yeah, absolutely. Some of them are actually from other scientists. We had a guy who walked in and said, have you tested for ATP yet? So ATP is sort of the energy coinage, and nobody's actually made ATP in these kinds of experiments before. So it was like, yeah, we'd love to, but, it costs a huge amount of money, and it's really difficult to isolate tiny amounts of materials. And he said, oh, no, I've got this wonderful machine I can bring in, and it'll test basically femtomoles of ATP. If there's any in there, we'll be able to see it. Wow. I'm expecting to bring this huge apparatus. Turns out it's a handheld little thing that they sell at the company, which is used for testing for food contamination and stuff like that. It's phenomenal. We now use it as part of our performance when we're doing the experiments.
Excellent. So we're going to have to wrap this up, unfortunately, but it's really good to talk to you again.
And see you here.
Please, if you make a new discovery as a result of your artwork,
we think we're close.
Please announce it on Creative Disturbance.
All right, we'll do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.